This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. School administrators are a lot quicker these days to suspend or expel students who break the rules. As schools adopt so-called zero-tolerance policies, more and more kids find themselves pushed out of the classroom. And the statistics indicate that these policies are not evenly applied. Minority and economically disadvantaged students are far more likely to get kicked out than white kids. And those who are suspended or expelled are far more likely to get into trouble with the law. This has led to a phenomenon some advocates call the school-to-prison pipeline. We're going to spend this hour talking about that phenomenon from a number of perspectives. We're going to start with Mike Anderson. He was in the pipeline. His troubles with school led to more time on the streets, and that landed him in jail. When he got out, he decided he wanted to help young people avoid the hard times that he experienced. Mike Anderson is founder and director of the organization Polished Souls, and he joins us now to talk about that program and his experience. Tyrone Tapp is with us as well. Tyrone is a participant and a youth ambassador for Polished Souls. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have you on the show.
It's good to be on the show, and it's definitely be an honor.
Mike, tell us about Polished Souls, how it began and what it does.
Well, Polished Souls is a 501c3 organization that is designed to help at-risk and adjudicated youth.
Now, let me stop you there. Adjudicated means they've already been charged with a crime.
They've been charged with a crime.
The criminal justice system.
Exactly. Right. Gone through the juvenile delinquency system and have actually been in a situation where we can say, through cliche, that they have fallen.
Mm-hmm. So those are the kids you're aiming for. How does it work? What do you do?
Well, what we do, we take an alternative way of teaching these kids that they do have gifts. Our motto is that every diamond in the rough is a soul that deserves to be polished. And we truly believe that because I've come from that myself. A lot of times in the school system, we may have the foundation of curriculum. However, that particular curriculum may not know how to direct, you know, the focus of a non-sequential learner. It's okay to be a sequential learner. You can learn your math, your science, or whatever. But there are gifts that exist above and beyond that particular curriculum. So what we do, we take the alternative route, like be it the arts. That's what we focus on. Are you a poet? Are you an actor? Are you a singer? Are you somebody that can be a debater? Are you somebody that can be part of liberal arts, performing arts, or even visual arts? There's a gift there that has a tendency to not be focused upon when they're in a regular school system. It's always the school of arts. But what's the school of arts? Something that may cost money for tuition or whatever. If you're underprivileged and you're not in that environment where you can afford that, then you don't go there. You don't get your gift discovered. You don't get your talent discovered. What we do with Polished Souls is we find out what it is that's inside of this particular person, even after they've fallen, to say, let me find out what it is that's inside of you that we can develop, nurture, and get you to rise back up before you go through what I went through, you know.
And you can do that. You can fall, so to speak, very early and find yourself in the criminal justice system 14, 15 years old. And
definitely.
Then it's pretty hard to get yourself out. You're working now. You recruit from Lakeview Alternative School in Durham. So tell us what that school is and sort of how kids end up there.
Well, Lakeview Alternative is a school where a lot of these students are sent to because for some reason I feel like the school system – so to speak, has this zero tolerance. And that's been promoted in the public media. It's been promoted through the legislative. And this is something that really hurts our children. If you want to develop a zero tolerance for children, then you don't understand the concept of children. So this Lakeview Alternative School is where some of these people are sent for behavioral problems, so to speak. I think it's because these children are not understood because they're different and they're special and they're gifted. And if you can't keep their attention, it frustrates you. And so what you're really seeing is the failure of your system. So you feel like you have to send them to another system. To me, Lakeview is a place where I feel a lot of the youth go and don't realize that there are people that don't believe in them. I decided that we had to go into Lakeview and say, let's believe in these kids.
Let me ask Tyrone how you became involved in the program. How did you get involved in Polished Souls?
I was in class one day and they announced on the intercom to come to the cafetorium. That's what they call it, the cafeteria and the auditorium together. And we was in there, we was just chilling, and a man came in there and he gave his speech on his project he was doing about Polished Souls. And, you know me, I said I want to be an actor. So, yeah, I was, you know, wandering off, laughing and playing or whatever. And then he spoke to me out of the whole crowd. He spoke to me. And I'm like, exactly what he said. We're not going to speak on it, but exactly what he said, it kind of got to me. when I thought about it, I was like, maybe he might be right. Maybe I need to change a little bit. So he at the end of the class, he asked, like, who wanted to be a part of the program. And I raised my hand, and ever since then, he been helping me or whatever.
How did you get to Lakeview?
That
was a deep breath, a long sigh, and those eyebrows went straight to the top of your head.
Yeah, because I don't really like talking about the past, but...
Let me ask you this. Let me put it this way. You had been suspended a number of times, right?
Yes.
From school. And when did your suspension start? What grade were you in, and how often roughly? I mean, was it a lot? Did you get – and how many days?
I would say my suspension started second grade.
Yeah.
You know how young kids have with water guns, toy guns, any kind of gun. Uh-huh. I just so happened to put my water guns in my book bag. And I went to school, and it was we had to go to the bathroom, and I'll never forget this day. I put the gun in my pants, and we went to the bathroom. The teacher turned her head, and I pointed the gun at somebody's head and said, "Get in the bathroom," and she caught me. I didn't get suspended, but I got sent home the rest of that day. Yeah. I received 2 butt whippings.
The last time you brought a gun to school, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that was the last time.
But that was not the last time. So the second grade, but then you were suspended many times since.
Yeah, third grade, fourth grade, I don't know.
Right. And same kinds of things? I mean, what sort of things would you do to...
I'm not a troubled person.
Yeah.
But like I said before, I have a short attention span that... I'm not diagnosed with it, but I know I have a short attention span, and I can't really sit and listen to someone talk, and if it's not catching my attention, then my mind wanders off. So I have a hard time with that at times. Sometimes I know how to control, sometimes I don't. But some teachers know how to work with me with that.
Yeah. So what happened in Polished Souls? Tell us what you did, and did it change things for you in terms of being able to sit down or learn things?
Polished Souls helped me. Helped me realize, like, it's not all about following. I have a child now, and it taught me how to become more of a leader than a follower. I just want to set the best example for my daughter. And, yeah, basically.
You wrote a script based on the birth of your daughter, right?
Yeah, that day was pretty terrifying. That was my first time going through something like that, and I didn't really know what to do. Like, I didn't know what to get down on the floor and cry with her, or like, I didn't know what to do. So I called my mom, and my mom got there as fast as she could. We called the ambulance, did everything that we were supposed to have done, and yeah.
Yeah, but you ended up writing a script. Mike, tell us about that. Why encourage him to write a script about that, or what was the instruction?
So I take it back to my days of youth. There were so many things inside of me that were created fears that I even created myself. And I noticed as when I was involved, you know, with my incarceration period in the prison system, when I was serving that life sentence, I noticed there were so many things about my past that I needed to write about to conquer that fear. And the first question I asked, what is a day that you can remember where you were most fearful? And Tyrone had a tendency to say, well, I think it was when my daughter was born. And so I said, well, take it and write that. Create a script and see why it is that you feared that at that moment. One of the things that I used to do was write about my life. And my biggest fear was when my father practically lost his mind and held us hostage at gunpoint. So we had to go through a domestic violence shelter for the whole summer. And I was 9 years old when that happened. I was traumatized. And I know there's a level of traumatization that exists in each child, even when they go through trouble. You know, you may not consider yourself a troubled youth, but however, there's a level of traumatization that nobody teaches you how to cope with it. So the reason why I got these youth to write these scripts, because it was part of SKIT, the program that I implemented into Lakeview. And SKIT stands for Spreading Knowledge in Theater. So with this actual practice, they were able to write the script of their most terrifying day. Tyrone chose this day. And then when we went back and looked at it, I said, well, why was it that you felt this way? And he was able to understand after reviewing that, oh, wow, that this is why I felt this way.
Well, let me ask you that, Tyrone. What did you feel after you looked at a script? You obviously experienced it once. Then you wrote about it. Did anything change when you read what you wrote? How did you feel?
Now that I look back on it, it was kind of funny. Because I see my reaction and how I was reacting, because it looked like I was panicking. But No, I don't really feel how I pictured it. It's still the same.
Right, but you had a different reflection about yourself. You saw yourself in a new light. And then, Mike, I guess that what you do after you talk to everybody about that is that you can use those observations and then reflect that back.
Exactly, and it gives me the opportunity to deal with them one-on-one, to figure out, you know, what it is that they want to figure out about themselves. And this gave me the opportunity to show that Tyrone was more, you know, in tune with his more profound self than anything. There was an in-depth level about himself that now he can understand, and he can bring the leadership to the forefront because he knew what his weaknesses were. He knew what his strengths were. And by writing and reflecting upon that, we're able to develop what it was that he wants to do. Now, his biggest dream is to be, you know, an actor, to be able to develop different characteristics out of who he is with his sense of humor, with his sense of existence, and to become above and beyond what the system has deemed him to be.
Well, then you can say you got your start in public radio on the state of things. Acting career began
here resume.
After a fine education with Mike Anderson, who is the founder and director of the organization called Polished Souls, Tyrone Tapp, participant and youth ambassador for Polished Souls. This is all part of our American Graduate Series today on the state of things as we talk more about the school-to-prison pipeline and some of the alternatives. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline, and that's a name given to the cumulative effect of school policies and practices that actually steer young people toward the criminal justice system. Mike Anderson is the founder and director of a youth program called Polished Souls. Tyrone Tapp is a participant and youth ambassador for Polished Souls. And joining our conversation now are Jason Langberg and Rukia Dillahunt. Rukia is a retired educator and now a parent and student advocate for education justice. Jason Langberg is an attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. He's with the Advocates for Children's Services Project. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I want to ask Mike another question about, Mike, your experience with school, whether you were suspended frequently and kind of where that got you. We made reference to it, but we didn't really get the story.
Yeah, I actually went through a process where I was suspended on several occasions, even for times when I wasn't the culprit of the actual action. I remember being stole, and stole was a word that we used to say that we were sucker punched right in the middle of the hallway in school, and I still got suspended. So, you know, there were times that there were big fights. There was a big fight that broke out between me and one of my best friends and probably a group of five other people, and we got suspended during that time. There were so many things that I can recall that I did get suspended for, even starting in middle school. Matter of fact, starting in elementary school. And a lot of that time, I knew I was suspended. I knew I was put out of school, but there was no type of reproof behind it. There was nothing that admonished me and made me realize what it was that I was really doing and what I was wrong for. So it was part of what stirred up an anger inside of me, you know, a rebellion. And probably by the age of 14, I went into the streets. I became involved with a lot of things in the streets. I was selling weed in school because, you know, I felt like I needed money. There were times that I felt like the clothes that I had on did not live up to the standards of what the public school system that I was in. There was just so many things that, you know, I chose to do. And I did take I take responsibility for the choices I made. But a lot of those choices, they escalated and they led up to a series of criminal behavior. So by the time in 1991, I found myself in the Cumberland County Jail facing the death penalty plus life plus 60 years. I stayed in the Cumberland County Jail for almost 3 years, and I took a plea bargain for life. And so while I was serving that life sentence, I had to reflect back on my childhood. I served 17 years on that life sentence to be released on Mother's Day of 2008, which was a great gift from my mother. However, when I was serving that time, I realized there was a parallel between the education system and what I was doing. Because while I was on the inside, I was the youngest person in the Cumberland County Jail that they asked to go babysit the juvenile block. Why did they come to me? Because they tested me before I went in, and they felt like there was a level of non-sequential education that existed inside of me that can actually nurture these young guys that was in the juvenile cell block. I went in. I was 19 years old. The youngest one before me that they ever had was 26 years old, and he was just sent out because they could not relate to him.
Yeah.
So they beat him down with a mop wringer. But anyway, while I was in there, I noticed that the education level itself actually match the statistics. They say the highest level of most of the incarcerated black males of education is between sixth grade level and 10th grade level. So to me, that leaves a gap of non-success. So as I went through the prison system serving my life sentence, I said, you know what? I'm going to take advantage of every educational opportunity there is. I got my business degree. I got my computer systems technology degree. I took 9 different trades. And then I began to educate myself with research and writing. I began writing my own books, 2 of which are published right now. A lot of things that were streams of income that I know that I could create for myself by educating myself, I did so on the inside. So once I was released, I was able to come to a whole totally different environment that I wasn't even from, nowhere that I grew up, and fit into society as a very productive person. And that's what I think the biggest issue with the system is, to show these kids how there are alternative ways to become productive members of society.
Well, let me ask Jason, because I know, Jason, you're working with the Advocates for Children's Services Project with Legal Aid. How typical is Mike's story? It seems to me the outcome, it may not be typical, but the way he got himself to prison and the connection between that and the suspension in the school system, is there a connection, or is this just not correlated at all? What are you finding?
Yeah, there's definitely a connection, and we see this regularly in North Carolina, which has one of the biggest school-to-prison pipelines in the country. So in 2011-12, public schools in North Carolina gave out over 260,000 suspensions, which added up to over 800,000 school days. In addition to the suspensions that are being given out, we're seeing students go to school each day being harassed by the police officers who are based in the schools, being referred to the court system for minor misbehavior that's happening at schools. So in North Carolina, we have almost 1,000 school resource officers, which are basically law enforcement officers assigned to the schools, patrolling every day. And 43% of our kids who are involved in the juvenile system in North Carolina are there because of school-based court referrals. So we're seeing indirectly students are ending up in the justice system because they're pushed out through suspension and then get in trouble while they're out on the streets. And then more directly, they're being referred straight from the school system to the court system, which has even worse consequences in North Carolina because we're the only state in the country that automatically prosecutes our 16 and 17-year-olds as adults with no chance of them returning to the juvenile system.
Pretty strong correlation between suspension and contact with the criminal justice system then, right? Well, let me ask you this, though. Here's the rationale for that, Jason. Schools, we got to keep our schools safe. There are kids in there. It's a learning environment. We can't have violence. We can't have disruption. We're trying to teach here. We need to do something to keep our schools safe.
Yeah, I think everyone would agree with that. But the research shows that suspension doesn't actually make schools safer. And it also doesn't show that police officers in schools make schools safer. In fact, there's research showing that suspensions actually make schools less safe because they're alienating students. They're putting them out on the streets where they can become involved in gang activity or criminal activity. They're causing those students to fall further behind in school and then ultimately dropping out. And so suspensions aren't effective at deterring misconduct. They're not effective in any kind of punitive way. Instead, they cause major behavioral problems, major mental health problems, and major academic problems for students. So I think people agree that something needs to be done, but from our perspective, that something needs to be positive. That something needs to be rehabilitative and not punitive. So instead of suspending students, instead of referring them to court, we need to look at what best practices are out there in terms of keeping schools safe and fair. Things like restorative justice programs, peer mediation, high-quality alternative schools, community service programs. There are positive alternative consequences that we can use not only to help rehabilitate the child, but to keep the school environment positive and safe.
Rukia, you worked in the Wake County school system for, 43 years, right? So
33 years in Wake County, 10 in New York.
All right. Mm-hmm. So you've had some experience in a classroom. Mm-hmm. Have you seen the change over time, change to the zero tolerance policies?
Sure. And, you know, the latter part of my years, 15 years in Wake County, I spent at the alternative high school, Mary E. Phillips High School. I say it was, and it probably still is, the best alternative high school in the state. And so we served students there who hadn't been successful in any of the other high schools in Wake County, or better still, sometimes middle school students. So we did see that zero tolerance, as it started to develop, begin to suspend more students. And what we looked at Phillips was trying to help students learn how to communicate better. That I always used to tell teachers as an administrator, you know, we don't have virgin ears. So, you know, when we don't do not want students to be disrespectful, but let's look at what kind of day did they have when they came to school. And so, you know, we try to really instill in our faculty and staff, as well as for me as an administrator and a principal, to look at how do we become, you know, more intervention. You know,
well, let me ask you about
skills.
The outcomes, because we know that there's a strong correlation between suspension and contact. If you're suspended a lot, especially early on, you're going to end up in the criminal justice system, and it's a pretty lockstep correlation. And not everybody gets to the alternative school.
Right.
So were there better outcomes with that alternative school?
It was. And I mean, I as I look at it and I think about my husband, because he always said you should have collected all that data of the students you graduated. Yeah. But if I look at the 15 years as I was there, and just use a minimum class size of seniors of 60, and sometimes we had higher, like 75 or 80, you would look at thousands of students that graduated from Wake County Public Schools with a high school diploma and would not have graduated from any other high school in Wake County, and I probably safe to say in the state. And so those students now I see in the community with jobs, they are very thankful, and they'll say, oh, I show Ms. Dillahunt, I appreciate everything you did for me, but I sure to give you a fit. And I was like, yes, but look at you now, you know.
Well, that's what you tell your husband, because I taught in an alternative school. You just tell him it's everything you can do just to get that lesson plan together.
That's
somebody
right.
else better be collecting the data. Thank you. Let's talk about the suspension rates, though. They're not evenly applied, are they, Jason? There is a real racial disparity when it comes to suspension rates in our schools.
Right. In almost every district in North Carolina, black students, students with disabilities, low-income students, and students with who are English language learners are disproportionately pushed out. And it starts really with the achievement gap data and seeing how far behind our students of color are and our economically disadvantaged students, because when you're failing academically, you lose incentive to stay engaged, to do your work, and you sort of lose motivation. So I think that's where it really starts in schools, and then it moves into disparities at every other level. So when it comes to suspensions, we see that 56.8% of them are given to black students. Long-term suspensions, it's 54%, even though those students only represent about a quarter of the students in North Carolina. And then when we look at individual school districts, we see that the data is even worse. So, for example, in Wake County, a black student is six times as likely as a white student to get a suspension.
And it's not just, I mean, you can't make the argument that maybe they're six times more disruptive, because if you compare apples to apples, I've got just a couple statistics in front of me. Cell phone use, first time offender, 72% of black students who are first time offenders will be suspended, 29% of white students, 72 to 29 for the same offense. So when you compare apples and apples, aggressive behavior, first time offender, 41% black students, 9% white, same charge. Disruptive behavior, 34.8% black, 13% white. There is a real disparity in the way these suspensions are being distributed.
Right, right. And that data is from Wake County, but it holds steady pretty much across the state. Where we see that disproportionate push-out rate.
So, Rukia, on the hunch that I mean, racism is at some sort of racial consciousness is at play here. The statistics are pretty clear. On the hunch that the counties don't go out of their way to find racist teachers, what's going on? Nobody will, you know, sort of cop to that.
You know, I think that's really a good issue, because we struggle with that all the time when we have training, professional staff development for teachers. We go under the auspices of diversity. We don't want to talk about racism and race. And I think it's until that is reached for us to understand, you know, the systemic piece of racism and institutionalized racism, that it's going to exist. And that's why the achievement gap exists. And we can't see one without the other, as well as the connection with the suspension rate and the push out to school to prison pipeline. And so I think it's very key. And there are a lot of teachers who ask for the training and not just water it down to the diversity piece or the poverty piece,
right.
You know, because they use that word with poverty, you know, oh, these students students can't learn. That's not true.
I think that's where it builds in. If you understand that there are differences, racial differences, economic differences, it's when you make a connection, albeit an incorrect one, about the possibilities and expectations. And that really, even in testing, right, Jason, where kids are disproportionately placed in, say, learning disabilities classes who are tested later and they should have been put there. So misplaced from second grade on, and then the trouble begins. How much of it has to do with expectations?
Well, a lot of it does. So there's no evidence to suggest that black students are misbehaving more often or more intensely. There's also studies that have been done around this issue have held steady socioeconomic status and shown that black students are still being disproportionately pushed out. So that class issue only has a minimal influence on the disparate rate we see with black students, as does low academic achievement. The studies that have looked at that, there's a lot of them, no conclusive evidence, but a lot of it has to do with, for the most part, starting in the classroom with disparate office referrals, which was called sort of differential selection. And some has to do with that, which is about perception and implicit bias. And some has to do with cultural mismatch between who's working in the school and who are the students in that school.
Tyrone, let me ask you a question about sort of how you felt in school. And again, you're just now beginning to think back and reflect on yourself. You went through it all. But as you look back over it, how do you get – you're listening to all this data. We're giving you all this information. How did you feel you were treated? Did you have a sense that there was something going on here, or was it you're kind of focused on your own behavior and, yeah, maybe I did the wrong thing?
In Lakeview?
In school before you got to Lakeview with all the suspensions going on.
Oh, well.
I mean, did you feel like you were being treated differently?
No. I mean, I felt like I was being treated like everybody else was being treated. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just chose to do what I wanted to do, you know, like any other teenager. Right. I'm not with the whole, you know, racial thing. Uh-huh. You know, I'm very open to everybody. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, they doing this because of this right here. No. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is us, but we not going to, you know what I'm saying, admit that. We're going to blame it on the other person. That's just how it is sometimes. But other than that, no, I don't think I've been treated differently.
Yeah.
I think everybody in there liked me. You know, everywhere I go, everybody always liked me. I'm a very friendly person.
Sometimes you just carry that class clown just one step too far.
Yeah.
And then you get what's coming. But that I guess is the other question, is whether class clown and acting out in one case, Jason, ends up being a suspension, and in another case being sent to the principal's office.
Right. So, you know, now that the state statute around school discipline was changed in 2011, we really don't have as much zero tolerance across the state. It's been pretty much eliminated except for ones that are mandated by federal law. But what hasn't changed is the zero tolerance mentality. So we still have principals out there. We still have school boards out there who see certain kids as troublemakers or perpetrators and other kids as victims. And it's that mentality that we have to get the perpetrators or the troublemakers away from the innocent victims. And I think another thing that needs to be mentioned here is austerity. And so when we're talking about racial disparities with all the budget cuts and austerity we're seeing in the public schools, that has a disproportionate impact on racially segregated schools, high poverty schools that need those resources more than other schools, if we're talking about equity, to deal with incidents of misbehavior. If you can't pay for alternatives to suspension, if you can't pay for appropriate interventions and prevention services, what's happening is that the schools aren't necessarily wanting to suspend students. It's not that we don't see teachers who go out there with these evil motives necessarily, but what we're seeing is they're left with no choices because the school systems don't have the funds they need to provide proper special ed services, academic interventions, alternatives to suspension, have small school sizes and classes, the things they need to do to really prevent misbehavior in the first place, they don't have the resources to do.
Yeah, and on top of the alternative and special programs, they're cutting the basic programs. So you're adding to class size, you're taking teacher's assistants away, you're making it harder on every school. And, of course, that falls most heavily on schools in the poorer districts. And, Mike, you talked about that, just not having the programs for you when you started getting in trouble.
Exactly. I can recall that whenever you got in trouble, whenever you got suspended, you would be put back into a category that made you less privileged to certain programs. So why not focus your attention on somebody that needs those programs versus that person that you feel like is more advantaged or somebody that can make your program look good? One of the things I've always noticed about certain programs is that they have a tendency to shy away from a certain particular group of youth because they feel like this particular group of youth will not let their program look successful. And in this community today, you have a numerous amount of individuals that are willing to go in and say, look, I can provide an alternative program. This is what I wanted to do with Polished Souls. I'm educated. I've experienced that situation. I can go back and reflect upon my childhood up until my adulthood, and I can go back and decipher my decisions that were made versus my decisions that are made now and create this same curriculum for this same thought process and implement it into these particular group of youth that you feel like are not advantaged or privileged to these programs.
On the state of things today, the American Graduate Program continues with a conversation about the school-to-prison pipeline. Mike Anderson, founder and director of the organization Polished Souls. Tyrone Tapp, a participant in that program. Thank you both very much for being on the program
today.
Thank
you for having us, Frank. It was an honor.
Our conversation will continue with Jason Langberg, who's an attorney with Legal Aid North Carolina, an advocate for Children's Services Project, and Rukia Dillahunt, a retired educator from the Wake County Schools. Conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the effect of school discipline policies that some child welfare advocates say push poor and minority students into the prison system. We're looking at programs that may offer different solutions and better outcomes. Jason Langberg is an attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. He's with the Advocates for Children's Services Project. Rukia Dillahunt is a retired educator, now a parent and student advocate for education justice. And David Reese joins us now. He's the executive director of the East Durham Children's Initiative. That organization works with schools and families to foster deeper engagement with children and students in and out of the school. David Reese, welcome. Good to have you here.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the East Durham Children's Initiative.
So EDCI, as we commonly call it, is Durham's attempt to change outcomes for kids. We've taken 120 blocks within arguably the hardest, roughest part of East Durham. And what we said was we would walk children and families along a pipeline or along a journey towards college or career and success, but starting at birth and creating interventions using high-quality evidence-based interventions, promising practices which are already in existence back in Durham, to create a seamless web so we no longer lose families and children through the cracks.
So this is interesting. It's in a sense not a special program or a special school. You're working in a neighborhood with the school system to bring kids. How many kids and families are involved in EDCI?
Sure. So now, when you think about East Durham, these 120 blocks, we're talking about 3,200 kids, 0 to 18. You know, as we look at the demographics and further break it down, we're talking about a third of those kids is 0 to 5. And so this is a work in progress. Because as we start at birth, we go back to where the data says you should start. You know, we modeled the Harlem Children's Zone, and Jeff Canada made some mistakes. We're really happy for it because he helped us learn. But starting back at birth, and so this is about engaging every child that's willing, parent that's willing, at birth, working really diligently in early childhood and then through elementary school.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, we're very fortunate in Durham County that we have partners. And, you know, this is the part of creating this replicatable model. Because if we can make this work, when we make this work in East Durham, we can take it to other parts of Durham. Mm. We can take it to any other similar size city across America because we use existing resources. Mm. There are high quality evidence-based interventions which are currently providing services throughout our entire county right now. So it's early childhood. You know, there's Durham Connects. We identify every child that's born back within 120 blocks. Nurse visit in the home, baby visit there. Then there's in-home case management, which is provided by Healthy Families Durham. And that's case management weekly or monthly through age 3. You know, and we have interventions that then span back through elementary school at our target elementary school, Y.E. Smith. And then the beauty of this is there are partners who work back at our target middle school, Neil, and target high school, Southern High School.
So you don't – it's not every child and every family in these 120 blocks. You've got all the students who are going to those schools and all the families?
Well, you know, we have an interesting philosophy. And the philosophy is parents can opt in and parents can opt out. And then you can opt back in again. And these – the interventions are open for families who are at that ready stage ready with action.
And they have to be ready to participate, right?
They have to be ready to participate.
So tell us how that works.
Sure. So, you know, we have a parent advocate program. It's in the elementary school. Right now, we grow with each grade level. We're actually in pre-K through grade four right now. And this is a program where we help parents learn how to interact and be active participants back in their child's educational pursuits. But also, how do they communicate with the school? Help them redefine what parental engagement looks like. Parents can choose that I want to work with my advocate. My advocate will come and do a home visit with me. They'll come and they'll attend parent-teacher conferences with me. They'll help my child get engaged with other activities, other supports back within the zone. Or they can say, you know what, I don't want my advocate right now. But later on in December, things may change and that advocate all of a sudden then becomes an opportunity for me to just receive additional services for my child.
One of the criticisms you hear about what's going on in the schools is that, and you'll hear this frequently, is that the parents in minority neighborhoods, they don't care. They're not engaged with the kids, and that's the problem, and that's why they're getting in all this trouble. And what are you finding about that? Are there barriers to engagement, and are you breaking those down, or is that a myth? Are we misperceiving those who think that that's the problem? Is that a misperception? Tell us more about family engagement.
You know, family engagement is all based upon perspective. And so especially as we work with our families back within the zone, we really look to help redefine what parental engagement looks like. You know, when we think about it from a school perspective, what we clearly define as parental engagement is coming to my parent-teacher conference. And we do that, we check it off the box, and we check that box and say, I'm done. My parental engagement is taken care of. Well, you know, for us, we really begin to dig a little deeper. We start asking parents, well, you know what? Have you created this space for your child to actually do their homework? You're an engaged parent. Is your child having breakfast before they go to school? Are they getting to bed on time? Are they engaged in a summer activity, a structured summer activity? You know, then we can really truly begin to check off multiple boxes and help parents redefine what parental engagement actually looks like. And I think remove labels of saying that just because you live in a low wealth community, you're a parent of color within one of these communities, you're not engaged. You're less engaged. The statistics say you're going to be less engaged. Well, you're engaged and you can be even more engaged. And let us help you with some of the skill set development that's necessary to achieve some of those goals.
Rukia, let me ask you about the school systems that you've worked in. Are there barriers to engagement? Is it difficult for poorer families or minority families to get involved in ways that we might not notice?
It is, because one of the main ideas or involvement is the PTSA. And they are controlled by certain people and certain parents. And we could, you know, Jason mentioned earlier about the class system, you know. But parents of color are uninvited in the school system. And the school system may not want to admit that, but if you get a call, and just think about this all the time, that your son or daughter is misbehaving, and whether it's the second grade class or we can go to fifth grade and we can go to ninth and tenth and they're getting suspended, every time you get a phone call, it's bad news, or sad news, I should say. So parents, if you talk to parents of color, they want to be involved and they want to be engaged. But I would say 95% of the time when they go to the school, they feel uninvited. And so I think schools have to do more of having what I call an open door policy, where parents are welcome no matter what. You know, just very quickly, one time I called a parent and she was like, she saw my number on the phone and she was like, oh my God, what did he do? And I was calling to tell her that he had a very good day and he scored very high on a test. And she was like, oh, thank you. So we have to start our conversations, parent conferences, but what's good, you know, not all the time the misbehavior the students do. And I want to say this, too, that students often misbehave because they're not being successful academically. So we have to set, you know, the smaller class size is key, as well as having more interventions, more counseling, real counselors, you know, real psychologists. And when I say real, I mean a number of them in each school. So they can, you know, really talk and counsel students.
David, when you've obviously described some creative and productive ways to get parents involved that they may not have considered before. In your initial contact with parents, and you're going to talk about engagement now, do you hear some of what Rukia is talking about, their complaints or their sense that the system has not been inviting to them?
Absolutely. But I think that's the opportunity. And, you know, what we've done back within EDCI and our target elementary school, Y.E. Smith in particular, is change the environment, change the dynamic. The environment has to be inviting. So you're absolutely right. You're right on. You know, with our parent advocates, when you think about this, and, you know, I ask parents this all the time, how many times has a teacher been to your home? No one raises their hand, right? And then the next question is, well, how many times has someone from the school been to your home for something good? No one raises their hand. Everyone just looks at me in amazement. But that's part of this process. That's where this engagement has to start. You know, we hear the cliche all the time that we have to meet people and communities where they are. And this is part of beginning to meet communities where they are. You know, as we begin looking at teaching children who are in poverty, we have to then, I think, sometimes use somewhat different approaches, have different understandings about all the circumstances that happened before the child got to school. And part of that is, I think, teaching outside of the four walls of the school, which is a very different concept when we think about education as a whole. But this is, I think, one step at a time.
What about inside the walls? What mm-hmm. changes? How is it different for teachers and administrators in terms of their approach?
Yeah. So, you know, this is really interesting. When we started working on over at Y.E. Smith and Durham Public Schools, they're our largest partner, and they've just been a tremendous, tremendous asset to, I think, the success of kids back in the zone. There really wasn't a PTA. It was sparse. It was about five folks. And so we really redefined what engagement looked like, took that term off of the involvement for parents and just said, we need you to come out. We also began to incentivize parents. You know, and this is where this creativity really has to, I think, play a major role. And so now we've put the name PTA back on top of this parent group of 200 parents, which come on out to events. And so the parents are beginning to grasp this. But there's this other reality. We know in the past what really hasn't worked. And we know what has worked. And it's, I think, our responsibility as a community to become very, very creative as we look at changing outcomes for kids.
EDCI, Jason, is a big program. It involves the school system and it involves a whole area of the city. So it's comprehensive in that way. Is that what it takes? I want to get you to talk a little bit about, too, the sense of hostility that parents might feel in those neighborhoods and whether or not you have to take this comprehensive approach if there's going to be change.
Yeah, I think the comprehensive approach is important. I think first let me say that I think it's important to note that this issue of the school-to-prison pipeline is not about beating up on schools. There's enough people trying to undermine public education. You know, this market-based reform movement in education will talk about the pipeline and say, look what our schools are doing to students. But it's hard to engage parents when you have 30 kids in your class, when the guidance counselors are having to administer high-stakes testing all the time, when your social worker got cut, your nurse got cut. So if we're going to expect our public schools to engage with parents, we have to provide them first with the teachers with the time they need. If you ask why they didn't visit a parent's house at most public schools, they'll say, I was lesson planning till midnight and calling parents. So they need the time, and then they need the resources. They need their social workers back. They need their psychologists and counselors back, and not focused on high-stakes testing. So I think that's one thing. And then back to the comprehensive approach, yeah, I think we need that in our public schools, which will take resources. And so when it comes to engaging parents, I think before you start treating them before you start kind of implementing these new initiatives around parent liaisons and mentors and parent workshops and resource centers, which are all really great ideas, we first have to stop mistreating their kids, because it's going to be real hard to expect someone to want to be engaged when you're pushing their child into the school to prison pipeline unnecessarily. So I think that's where it begins, and that's what we're trying to do here in Durham, Wake County, and other places.
David, does EDCI sort of take account of some of what you talked about, looking at the things that don't work and the things that do? Clearly, when you look at some of the statistics in mainstream schools, there's something going on in terms of being pushed out. Have you addressed that directly and tried to figure out ways to avoid what is happening in other school systems?
You know, we have. I think this is also a continuous process. You know, I was just with the principal of our target school, Y.E. Smith, and we were just planning for the upcoming school year. And, you know, but part of the plan is, well, how do we look at reducing out-of-school suspensions back at the elementary school level? Because out-of-school means you don't learn, right? How do we create other alternatives? part of this as well is, I think, change of culture. And it's change of culture not only from a community perspective, because at EDCI we firmly believe it cannot be the schools by itself. I mean, this is a Durham effort. But also, how do we change culture back within the learning environment itself? That becomes key. When the environment and the expectations in the school change, when the culture within the school begins to change, then we can begin to have success. Then parents will feel the change and begin to become or want to become a greater part, a greater active participant.
What about resources? Jason points out, you know, it's one thing to say our schools are failing, mm-hmm. and then you cut spending, and then you come back 2 years later and say, see, they're failing even more. I mean, talk about self-fulfilling prophecy. You make classroom size larger, you cut the teacher's aides, and then you say, ah, look at that. It's even worse than it was 2 years ago. Does it take more resources? Does it cost more? Or how do we adjust? Do you have more people involved than we have in the mainstream school system?
Sure. You know, I think anything that's worth doing is going to be difficult. And I think there is a reality. You know, when we take a look at the Harlem Children's Zone, in which EDCI was modeled after, Jeff Canada has created a tremendously successful program. $76 million budget, though. And so what we knew here in Durham was that was not replicatable. We had to use existing resources, which is why I come back to this community effort. Every community across this country has these resources. Now, is there the community will, the desire to begin pulling these resources together? And, you know, I would argue, I think that communities across this country, I think also within the Triangle, within North Carolina, are beginning to look much more closely at the resources that are there and trying to figure out, well, how do they harness these resources, bring them back in a very, very coordinated effort. So this way we can provide the best outcomes and the best services and interventions for children and for families.
We're living in an environment where we're seeing lawmakers say, well, that means we can do more for less. Can we continue to cut the public commitment to education and pull these resources together and have a successful program?
Yeah. You know, it's amazing when you begin to think about some of the outcomes which are expected with, I think, the resources and the reduced amount of resources which are invested. It's a thing. I think it's a tremendously difficult situation to continue to be in. But part of this is the community. I think community investment, and that community investment has to happen from the
legislature. Is it all voluntary, or does there have to be a public commitment?
There has to be a public commitment. There has to be a public commitment, both at the state level, I think, as well as at the local level, for this to be successful. I think we have some of those commitments from the federal level, but we have to continue, I think, to work towards some of these similar commitments back on a state level. For us to have success, there's a reality. We all want a successful North Carolina. What are we willing to do to put in to achieving that goal?
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. David Reese, Executive Director of the East Durham Children's Initiative. Jason Langberg is an attorney with Legal Aid of North Carolina. He's with the Advocates for Children Services Project. Rukia Dillahunt, a retired educator, now a parent and student advocate for education justice. Thank you all for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been part of our American Graduate Series. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.